Good morning. Welcome to the Singularity Conference. I'm going to address a number of slightly related questions. First issue is, who are the Singularity experts? So as the conference says, Singularity here is roughly something like big future changes induced by smart machines or enhanced humans. Experts are the sort of people we turn to when we supposedly want to trust somebody about who knows something. The singularity field has honestly been largely ignored by academia, and many of you might think it's important, so you should be puzzled why such an important subject is ignored by academia. There's precedence in terms of other topics that were considered silly for a long time and still are aliens, sex, a variety of other things, where it just people looked at you funny if you were going to talk about that. Why does that happen? So at the moment, for example, I would say that the kind of person who most talks about singularity could be roughly classed in the tech luminary category, inspirational tech speakers talking about the grand tech future. If we think about different kinds of academic areas that might be relevant, on one hand, we have the sort of basis of the technology, the kinds of duct tape and things you're going to put together to make these things happen. Then there's people who study innovation and how various things get invented and put together and eventually marketed and delivered and how that changes over time. And there's a lot of people who study that, including in technology and in economics, how economies grow and adapt to these things and research development. And then there's, of course, larger social science that can help you analyze the social impacts of all these things. And perhaps at the end, ethics to help you judge whether these are good or bad things. Almost all of our discussion here is over here. Almost all the people who talk about this sort of thing are the tech experts. Why? Well, one story is that this subject flatters them, makes them important. These are the people who are going to change the world greatly, and people want to hear about that if you're a tech person. And these people over here, it doesn't flatter them or make them important. So maybe they're not so interested. But that doesn't quite explain why there aren't more of them. I guess another potential explanation is that these people over here don't think these people exist, in the sense that I was a physicist once upon a long time, and physicists sort of thought there just wasn't such a thing as social science. Sure, there were people over in that building, but they didn't know anything, and they were just making stuff up. And if you really wanted to like learn something about it, you'd have to have a physicist go study that stuff, because a physicist could really figure it out. And that's what I thought before I became a social scientist, which I am now, so I actually think we know things over here, and so I'll complain that there's not enough attention to this over here, and I'll try to add a little bit of that in later in this talk. Another way to cut the cake is to ask, in society we have a bunch of different kinds of experts, different categories of experts, who arguably serve different social functions, and by a social function I mean the various pressures on people who do that sort of thing, that reward them or punish them, encourage them, that shape the way they do what they do, how they do what they do, how often they do it, things like that. So we have some kinds of experts, like a computer fix-it guy. You hire him and he comes in and fixes something, and arguably the reason that he's there usually is that people have broken things they want fixed. But we have other kinds of experts who arguably serve other functions. You might want an accountant, not because you want your books fixed, because you want to show somebody else that your books are not fixed. We might have tech luminaries or to inspire audiences of tech people to go out and work harder because they're part of the future. Newspapers could be conversation starters. And then there's this academia thing, and academics say their purpose is, well, to produce knowledge for humanity, to make us all go forward. And the question is, how plausible is that? I'm also going to talk about prediction markets here, which are my alternative institution that perhaps can do better at some things. But let's pause and think about academia and what is academia's real function in society, because I think this helps you think about and understand what it does and what it can do and what you could make it do in the future. So the usual story about academia's function is, again, to advance the frontiers of knowledge in some grand collaborative effort. And another explanation I will offer here is that it fundamentally lets people affiliate with other people who have been credentialed as being impressive. humans evolved in a large, especially large tribes dominated by coalition politics, where it was very important to join a coalition, to be part of it, to be seen as being tied with high status people who could defend you and support you. And we are very interested in collecting affiliations with people who are high status and are likely to be loyal to us. So if you look at what academics do, you'll see that they, when they evaluate papers, although they say they're trying to, you know, advance knowledge, when they evaluate papers, they're usually looking more for difficulty, how hard was this, than really sort of how much insight will it advance, add to advance knowledge. If it looks easy, even if insightful, they'll often say no. Academics clump on a bunch of very strange, obscure topics, then leave big gaps between them, like this sort of topic here. They've got strangely stable institutions that last for centuries. It's very hard to enter. Students seem to care to go to schools where professors do research and ignore them. Research patrons seem to be surprisingly uninformed about what the people they're funding do and surprisingly uninterested. And similarly, if a reporter calls you up on the phone, they're looking for somebody from a good universe, good institution, and they're really flexible exactly in what your area of expertise is. They just want a quote from somebody from a top place. So, arguably, this sort of data suggests that, in fact, academia is about allowing people to affiliate with impressive people, and it serves that function well. It organizes people into groups where they affiliate, they credential their expertise, and they self-credential, and they make clear that they do that well together, and they do that about various topics on which they write, and as a side effect of all that, knowledge is advanced, and arguably it's the best institution in our society for advancing collective knowledge. Nevertheless, it's not what it's trying to do. Lessons are, therefore, don't expect it to focus on your silly topic if by doing so would make them seem less impressive to their clients or customers, because that's not what they do. Neither should you expect them to adopt your favored, more efficient method of producing knowledge if it also fails to better able them to credential themselves as being impressive and let people affiliate with them that way. Prediction markets are basically betting markets, or that's at least they started out as, easy to understand. There's betting markets on elections and various scientific topics. Actually, in 1994, I was helped to develop the first web market, which is a prediction market, just still up there, called the Foresight Exchange, where you can bet on various science and technology questions many years out, actually. The basic idea is that we are collecting forecasts by having many people sort of edit, and that we score their edits. Every time you make a change, there's going to be a accounting for that later. And if your change was not moving things in a good direction, then we will, you will be scored lower. And if your change was moving things in a good direction, you will be scored higher. And there are different ways to do the scoring and the consensus aggregation, but that's basically the idea. It's not about amateurs versus experts. And the keys are that we give people incentives to say what they think rather than what other people want to hear. They can self-select into the areas where they are the most expert and shut up about other stuff. So one of the main problems with most institutions is they don't give people an incentive to shut up when they don't know. And this does a better job of that. And it turns out they give you fast, accurate, consistent across a wide range of topics and answers that are also very resistant to manipulation, it turns out. And we have half a dozen or so comparisons over the last decade or so of this institution versus a variety of alternatives, and consistently prediction markets have beat or done the same as other institutions forecasting the same thing at the same time with remotely similar resources. Not to say that this will always happen, but in some cases the other institutions are just doing a good job and you can't beat it, you just decide that's what you want to say. In other situations they're doing a lousy job and prediction markets can beat it. Arguably, you can have prediction markets on a wide range of topics. The issue is, do you have a customer? So you could have prediction markets forecasting all sorts of things in cosmology or particle physics or all sorts of other areas in science or academia or technological progress. And the issue is, it doesn't happen unless somebody wants to pay for it, because usually betting markets are on things that people want to have fun betting on, which are short-term, easy to understand things they're engaged in, which may be technical questions, but usually not. You could have prediction markets even on something like the singularity. There would be a longer time scale, so there are more difficulties dealing with that, but it's feasible. And in fact, prediction markets have done better than other institutions in terms of doing better over the longer run by comparison, even though any forecasting is going to do worse when you're looking farther in the future. And there's actually a way to do what's called combinatorial prediction markets, where you can take a whole bunch of different variables, say, you know, when's the first robot of a certain capability, or when's the first moon colony, or whatever other things you're interested in, and you can lay those out and then actually ask people to update a joint probability distribution over all combinations of those things. So as to elaborate a full joint probability distribution over the scenarios that you're interested in. And that's actually technically feasible with a relatively small number of people. So I'll just set that idea out there. See me if you want to hear more. Now, getting back to singularity-related academic areas, as again I said I have a bit of a complaint that social science is neglected in analyzing the consequences of technology because, honestly, most technologists don't really understand how the social world works, and one of the illusions we humans have is that we think we understand how the social world works. People don't realize that they don't understand, so that they don't even think to ask for an expert. They sort of say, well, of course it works this way. And that's the struggle that most, say, social scientists have to teaching introductory students is to make them realize that they don't know, so that you can start to teach them what we do know. So let me try to summarize quickly sort of how the singularity looks like from the point of view of an economist like myself, and then I want to give you one sort of economics-like insight, at least, into helping you understand something like a singularity. So first of all, I have a paper from last summer that you can look at for some more of this stuff, at a blog called Overcoming Bias, where many things like these are discussed. So first of all, yes, on the general thing, something like a singularity will happen in the sense that there will be, eventually, general AI. It will be powerful. It will make an enormous difference. If you were projecting the future without taking that into account, you would miss a lot. So in that sense, yes, something like a singularity. Also, sort of yes, the changes that would be induced by that could be actually quite rapid. Say, even within a decade, you could have vast changes in society, or even a shorter time. So yes, sort of yes there. Now, not soon. I just really can't take seriously projections of stuff happening in the next 10 years in terms of, but within, say, a 98% confidence interval of 20 to 200 years, something really big will happen. I don't really think it's on trend. It's a trend projection. Economists, when we look at technology and changes, say that basically stuff has been steadily growing for the last 70 years or more. And although there's always some things are growing faster than the economy, other things are growing slower, and there's that all averages together to a relatively steady trend. So I don't think we're out of that trend or likely to be out of that trend for the next 10 or so years. But nevertheless, something eventually will happen because we can eventually see that this stuff is going to be possible. Perhaps the most dramatic or vivid way in which an economist kind of analysis of this sort of scenario differs from others is that we imagine these sorts of technologies arriving through the usual process of diverse organizations competing and communicating and trying to, for example, to develop a technology in order to sell it and to sell applications of it. And so you imagine people trying to make better machines that are smarter because they want to make money, and that this, when they eventually achieve something, they will be quick and eager to try to sell this technology to make money off of it, and then other people will be not too far behind in selling other variations, and that together a new industry would grow and could quickly grow to dominate the world economy even, but not that one particular person's project would dominate the world, it would be that a new industry would dominate. And this new industry would not likely decide to wipe out the rest of the world just because it's a new industry. All the firms that started after 1950 could decide to wipe out all the firms that started before 1950 by sneaking in the middle of the night and killing them all. But we don't tend to do that sort of thing because we're all embedded in a legal system that keeps the peace, and each of us relies on that to keep the peace. I especially don't think that you should think of this as a horizon in the sense of something you can't see past. You can use social science to understand the kinds of things that will likely to happen in what order, over what time scales, and having what detailed social consequences. All right, so my one advertised insight is that In history of economics, we've been thinking about machines and people and struggling with the concept of, are they substitutes or complements? So the oldest and the sort of standard science fiction image of machines is as a substitute for people. And this was actually Ricardo, a famous economist back in 1821, had a paper where he sort of analyzed that setup. And you get the scenario where if machines substitute for people and then machines are cheap, then people are cheap. And the wages people can gain fall to the wages the machines can get, although you have many other consequences. The other approach is that machines are complements to people. A complement is something that left shoes and right shoes are complements. The more left shoes you have, the more right shoes you would want. Red pens and blue pens are substitutes. The more red pens you have, probably the less blue pens you want, at least in terms of the color on the outside. Economists have said that machines have been complements to human labor for the last century and are likely, therefore, to continue because as we've had more machines and better machines, the wages have risen. It's more important to have valuable laborers who know how to work the machines relative to once you have better machines. But I think there's a way to take both of these perspectives and combine them into a way to understand why what has happened so far has happened and yet what may happen in the future would likely be very different. And the way to think about this is to say what we have is a very large range of tasks that we need to accomplish in society, we need to accomplish together, and those tasks are complements. The more better we do on one task, like moving boxes from A to B, the more valuable it is to do the other task well. But on each particular task, various things that can do that task are substitutes. If a machine does that task well, it will substitute and displace a person who does that task. And so what we have is long ago and initially, we have this landscape here of the human advantage, which is the tasks on the left are the tasks that machines are best at relative to people because humans have a low relative advantage. The tasks on the right are the ones where machines, people are very good at it relative to machines. And so when machines aren't very good, we only do a few tasks with machines. We do most of the tasks with people. But as machines get better, this water level rises and we substitute more and more along the coastline until later on, eventually, it could be that most of the tasks were being done by machines. In the early phase, what you will see is that as machines get better, overall wages would rise because overall the value of doing everything together rises. But if you get far enough over, that can switch to a situation where wages fall because depending on the shape of that landscape at the end there. If the landscape goes up like that, maybe wages stay up. If it stays flat, then the land gets flooded and basically wages fall. So that was my one promised insight. My time is up. I think I have a time for a few questions.
My name is Rick Schwab. Robin, it sounds like you're regarding AI like just robots, just like a product. They'll be stamped out. They'll be a commodity, and that's how they impact the economy. It sounds like it's almost like saying, well, Thomas Edison isn't that important. There's only one of him. You can only sell him once. How important could he be? You know, the thing about AI is, A, we'll have an opportunity to talk to somebody who doesn't think like us, and we ought to be willing to listen. And two, recursive self-improvement. It could get to be a lot smarter than us, and that's a whole different world. Whole different world.
So I'm not sure what you have in mind with the first comment. Yes, these products will be different from previous products and have many advantages over them, which is why people will buy them. Occurring in terms of recursive self-improvement, this is the key insight of economic growth, which is that the economy recursively self-improves together overall. It's very rare for one part of the economy, one James Bond villain on an island, to develop everything himself and make all this technology and threaten the rest of the world with it. Things grow because we grow inside an economy where we all exchange with the rest of the world economy, and we are able to grow fastest that way. So, yes, these things will self-improve, like all industries self-improve, by improving their technology and becoming part of a world that self-improves.
I was just thinking about your last slide where the land kind of stops and your slide doesn't go out more to the right or more up. I don't know if you could pull that up, but
this. Oh, sorry.
But it seems to me that it seems to me that the land does keep on going up. That the it's not just that there are two people left working, but in fact there are all sorts of other people who will be, you know, on the land a lot higher as time goes on and as the water level rises and the machines are doing more. But there'll still be lots of land, and the mountain keeps getting higher.
I was just told this has to be the last question. The shape of the land is the shape of human advantage relative to machines on doing a task. So if there's a world where there are many rich humans or even robots who just prefer to have a real human waiter or a real human artist, and they will only buy sculpture from real human artists, then there will be a remaining demand for real people to do things. And in a very rich economy with rich people able to splurge on all sorts of things, there will be a remaining demand for some people to do those sorts of things. And it could be that all the remaining humans can spend their lives doing those things as a tiny fraction of this vast robot economy that mostly does other things. And therefore, human wages would stay high. But still, humans would stay a small fraction in terms of that's a small fraction of the overall chart. Most valuable stuff will be done by the machines. And therefore, most income and money would go to people who were machines or own machines or own the inputs to machines, etc. Thank you. Oh, we're going back out.